Welcome to PageCast, a podcast series brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers, aimed to give you the story behind the story. By interviewing the authors responsible for some of your most loved books, we explore the thoughts, ideas, emotions, and creative processes that led to the writing of these books. If you're a reader with a zesty interest in people and stories, do stick around and enjoy what PageCast has to offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Thembela Mbatha, coming to you live on the PageCast, which is a podcast brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers. I'd like to send a special shout out to all my bookster friends, if you're listening. Today, we're joined by a lovely guest who is an author, a writer, agriculturist, public speaker, and a pioneer with an unquenchable passion for Xhosa heritage and culture. She's the founder of Homba Crafts and refers to herself as a Xhosa culture ambassador. She has a double master's degree in agriculture, climate change, and transition from the National University of Ireland and University of Montpellier Subagro in France. She has published two books, The Dissonant Rainbow, published in 2019, and To My Young Self in 2020. She currently lives in Bulungula on the Wild Coast, where she works for an NGO to provide rural schools with access to clean water and sanitation. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Usiso Mvakazinesi Nqandeka, who I will be chatting to about her newly launched book titled Don't Upset Omalume. Welcome, Messi. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Thembela. Thank you so much for welcoming me. Yeah, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, it's both a privilege and a pleasure for me to be chatting to you about this book today, as I've been beaming with pride and joy ever since it landed on my lap. And I mean, I've been inboxing you and saying all kinds of things because I can't believe, you know, something like this exists. So I'm very excited to get into the chat with you just to understand your thought process and just the creative process in writing something like this. So how does it feel for you to have it in hand?
Yeah, it feels amazing. Finally, when someone asks me something about the Xhosa culture, I can refer them, because I had received a lot of questions about different topics in Xhosa, and it was difficult to say, okay, I'm going to explain to you. But now I can just say, go to exclusive books, go to bargain books.
Yes, and there's a section of that. So, I mean, for me, if you ask me what this book means to me, especially just after reading it from cover to cover, it feels like a dream come true. It feels like you've answered a prayer, you know, because I remember a time when the start of the pandemic and, you know, people are getting sick and all kinds of things. And I always go back to, you know, how my gran raised us, and she'd always have sort of remedy, or and she'll go into a garden and she'll come back with something that would help ail whatever you were going through. So I always thought, okay, now when my gran had passed away, what and where would I go to get that knowledge? And you've come up with this book, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that is why I feel like it's an answered prayer for me. I don't know. I feel like the generation that, you know, our mothers and all of them are quite westernized, and they don't really, they always feel like they're so almost unsure of what it is. They have some knowledge, but not to the extent of which you've gone through in this book. So I want to try and, without fangirling too much, I've been taking it with me everywhere. I've just come back from the Eastern Cape a few days ago, and I sat in the sun and I ate umfino from my mom's garden while I was reading it. So I would want to understand from you when the idea to create a book like this occurred to you. And
yeah, thank you for that question, and thank you for the compliments. I hoped the book would do that. So the idea of the book starts when I come back from studies in Ireland and France, and I get back to the country in December 2018, and I'm excited with a double master's degree, international. I'm like, yeah, I'm surely going to score a good job, you know, a good paying job. And I get back to the country. First, it takes 1 year to verify my degrees, which was super stressful with SACA. Yeah. And then after that, I was like, okay, 2020, finally, I can look for a job. and then the pandemic hit, you know. So before that, I think in December 2019, I was like, you know what? After living in Tata with my brother and his wife, I was like, I'm just going back home to live with my mom because this is just not working. I'm pushing and nothing is happening. And when I get back home, I'm scared. I'm like, what's going to happen to me? You know, like, did I go to study to come live in the village and all that and all the questions we ask ourselves? Am I doing the right thing? And then in the morning, I'm like, wow, this is a beautiful view, you know, and I'm taking pictures. And I'm like, yo, beautiful dish of food. And I'm like taking pictures. And then I guess my mother, as a mom, she figured that I was quite stressed and in a dark hole. So she spotted that, oh, she loves taking pictures of things, of traditional things. And she would call me all the time when she, when there's something outside, something unusual, something funny, beautiful sunrise. She's like, do you want to take a picture? And I would take these pictures and I would make stories that I would post on my social media. And then within no time, maybe in a few weeks, people were like, we want more, post something. What do you have in mind today? And it became like this beautiful platform where people are able to learn about the Xhosa culture. So it was just memories of my childhood coming back at me, you know, like if I had a headache, my mom would disappear into the garden, get a herb, like you pour some water, put it in and give it to me. And I'm like, oh, this works, you know. But to be back in the village, it's like a beautiful marriage between the two because people know when to go to the clinic. Clinics are very far. Have your try in the traditional medicine. And if something persists or it doesn't work, then you're like, okay, that's fine. I'm going to go to the clinic. But people always have a solution. And then I find myself in that setup and I find myself with people on my social media buzzing to learn more. This is getting, it's becoming a lot now. And I'm like, in a nice way. And then I start just taking my posts, compiling them on Google Docs and starting to write a book. And yeah, that's how the book came about because people were like, please write this as a book. Because I was like, ah, guys. And I mean, it's funny because my previous books started on social media, but again, for some reason, I never see it. And I'm like, oh, oops, by the way.
I guess social media really does play that huge and vital role in just educating and sharing knowledge and stories. So I'm glad that your people had spoken to you and, you know, you came up with this book because, wow. It's really an important book, man. And I think it's got a long lifespan as well. So it sounds like you had, you know, some kind of assistance and people sharing knowledge with you and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, writing is a lonely place. I normally say when I define it that I go through dark holes. As much as it has been an interactive book, but to write and transcribe everything, you sit alone. And I normally write overnight, like, throughout the night because that's the most quiet time and I won't find disturbance from my phone notifications and emails and everything. So it is the dark hole. I do find whenever I write a book, I go into spaces and dark holes that I feel like I come out a different person all the time. Because in writing, for some reason, whatever topic I write about, I normally go back to my childhood. And going to childhood sometimes brings those triggers, those traumas and everything. And you find yourself sitting in the middle of the night, unpacking it and trying to relate it to whatever you're writing about. So, yeah, I've had my huge portion of dark phases and dark moments.
Yeah. Like, I mean, just reading the book and just for me, it felt like I was just listening to you sitting and you had the mic and you know, just taking us through what you've learned and also like the little idioms that you include here and there, because I've heard someone say, you know, a certain saying in passing and I was like, oh, that's why they say a certain thing like that. Like so I mean I really appreciate things like that. So I can imagine that it needs some quiet time and you just tending to yourself and thinking back a lot. So what was the most surprising thing that you learned while creating this book?
That's quite a difficult question. But there have been surprising things about my culture or about people specifically, because I would be just sitting and asking questions from elder women that are working at the lodge because I spent time with them, 3 months with them towards the end of 2020. And then we'll be talking about girls' abduction, you know, how it used to happen. And to me, it feels very far because, I mean, it never happened to me and it never happened to people very close to me. So it always felt like the girl next door was abducted, something very far. And then I would chat, and then the elder mama would say, actually, that's how I got married. And I'm like, oh, that happened at 15. And I'm like, oh my God, that just came very close. So to me, it's been stories of the people I was asking from that felt so, because, I mean, of course, when you're writing about culture, it feels like, oh, something ancient, something very far. And then if someone was in their 50s, and they tell you about all these scary things that happened to them when they were children, and being a girl and being forced to marriage, or your father taking you out of school because you're a woman, you're a girl, and he can't be educating you. It's a waste because you're going to be taken by another family, things like that. So I think that for me, I still can't get over it, the fact that these things happen to the people we live with. And to them, it's like, oh, it's culture. I mean, what were we supposed to do, you know? And with grief, but it's like, whatever would be, will be. Whatever was, you know? That has been very interesting for me.
With that being said, and talking to women in itself, and because there's so many inequalities within our culture, right, when it comes to how women are treated, and it's things, like you're saying, they kind of, you know, let it go, and people move on. And so, I mean, having grown up in a village myself, I can account to some inequalities, or rather toxic behaviors that women have endured and continue to experience today. With that said, what are you hoping we can do as this generation to make our culture more inclusive of women? I'll give you an example of myself, just being a newly wedded Xhosa wife. And when I got married, there was a long list of things that I was expected by my new family. They had, you know, like expectations of me, my appearance. I was given new clothes to wear. And when it comes to my husband, and obviously he's now, married within my family, or his in-laws, right? So he's not expected to dress up a certain way. He remains. Isn't that, you know, an equality in itself? I've questioned things like that. And I'm hoping to get more of your insight on something like that. And how can we reassess these gender roles within our culture?
Yeah, so it's funny that you ask this, because I always say I doubt if I'll ever marry into my culture, because there's just so much bullying, you know, towards women. I think I commend and I take you people who marry into our culture as brave, because, I mean, it's ridiculous what's expected of women. But honestly, absolutely, the first thing I'd like that our generation should look into is lobola, the bride price. Is it something necessary? Is it not a transaction now that elders use to buy and sell whatever, whoever they want and what they want to get out of it? And when I look at it, it's such a frustration to the newlyweds, because the husband has to take a loan. I mean, we have no cars right now. He has to take a loan to be able to pay that bride price. And the prices on our heads as educated women, independent and all that, they are quite big. You know, I once asked my mom at some point, how much am I worth? And from the top of her head, she was like, 100,000. And I was like, oh my God, that's a lot of money. You know, and I'm like, I told her that, oh, that means my husband would starve before he gets that money, you know, in debt when we were newly wedded. And she was like, how is it your business? And I'm like, it's my business, because I'm getting to, I'm starting a family from a debt, you know. Elders feel very defensive. It's culture. It's something that's been done over time. And they feel like it has to continue, but it's really against us. If you realize now in our culture, the partnership, the companionship in the marriage relationship in our culture, because it's so much there's so much inequality. When a man marries, he gets someone to look after him, to work for him, to do his laundry, to cook for him, to do everything. Yeah, when a woman marries, she has nobody to do anything for her. She becomes a slave. Because as a newly wedded woman, you're expected to rise up early and sleep late after everyone. You do the dishes, you make tea, you wash the, you do the laundry and do everything. And I'm like, what the heck? Because we're both working, you know, your husband and you are both working. You go out in the morning to work and you come back. Each of you are tired. So I don't see why then you should slave away after you come back because you have to take care of a man.
I think for me, Mercy, more than anything, it's the fact that it can't be shared amongst each other. It's almost frowned upon that a man can be seen in the kitchen.
Doing dishes.
You know, their household. Why is it something that is frowned? It makes no sense.
Exactly. Yeah, the relationship, that is very unequal. We need to look into that in this generation. I do think there is hope. I do think people are still, but I think we should be deliberate and talk more about it and create spaces that encourage it.
Being wedded into a family that is quite open-minded, I've been able to talk to, you know, them about, you know, how certain things make me feel. And I think that isn't something that's quite been done before. It's always about what they want and what they need. Or who knows the size. All the words come out and you're labeled for being a difficult person, but I mean
for sticking out for yourself.
Yes, and I think who's gonna stick up for me if I don't? So Mercy, talk us through the title of the book, Don't Upset Omalume. How did you come up with that title?
Don't upset Omalume. Actually, we're playing around the titles with Annie and Charles because we're trying to find a title that fits the book. Because you can see that the book is very light and not heavy and just playful and jokey. So, yeah, we had a couple of titles that came. And Don't Upset Omalume was the one we all said, okay, we love it. Because we're brainstorming, we kept brainstorming, email, like, this is what I'm thinking, three titles I'm thinking about, blah, 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 okay. And then Don't Upset Omalume, boom, okay, that's it. We are taking this one. So it's in the context that as a child or a person who lives in the big cities starting there, when you come to the village, you know these coconut kids who come back and they can't speak Xhosa, and Malume, I mean, his English is not on top of his game. And he's struggling to hear this child with this Popeye accent. And then it's like, okay, Don't Upset Omalume, you should just step up your Xhosa game. When you go to the village to talk to Malume, you should impress Malume. So it's about that. And Malume, because in our culture, you know that our families are woman-headed, like single women. So the father figure become Omalume, that is uncles, mothers, brothers. So it's in that context.
No, I love it a lot. It really does stick. And I don't think anyone can forget it once they've seen it. So you speak highly of your mom and your grandmother in the book, which I really admire, and the lessons that they've passed on to you, including the gift of Inkliyo, translated as the Virgin Girl's bead cover. Can you share more about the responsibility that comes with you having to nurture and guide the youth about this cover, and also just the generations to come in your family when you're needing to pass it on?
Yeah, so yeah, you know, when my mother gave me Inkliyo, it was out of the yellow, completely. I didn't think of it. I knew that she had it in our property, but it was none of my business. It was her Inkliyo, her own. It's like an underwear. It was an underwear, like when she was younger in the 70s, late 60s, 70s. She gave it to me that day. That was when I was home, actually, when I had moved home. So I think she was looking for anything to light up my day, to make me happy. And she had already realized my line of interest, that is culture. And when she gave it to me, my mother is a person of few words, but when she gave it to me, she said, when you go to do these talks in the places that you talk at, because I already was doing public speaking, show people this and tell them this is what your mother wore. This is what we wore in our time. And nobody raped us. So she was like, rape is not about what you're wearing. It's about someone's issues, you know. It's about someone's cruelty. And that really stuck with me, that statement. She was not giving it to me to say, oh, you should remain a virgin. But she was saying, when you talk about rape, show people what we wore.
Yeah.
And they will understand that it's not about what a girl is wearing, you know. And so that became such a big thing. And that interview was made by my grandmother. My grandmother was a bead maker, my mother's mom. And my mother had never been, she didn't like beads. And so to see something that was made by my grandmother, something so sacred and special, And it's still, like, when I look at it, it still had red clay because she dipped it. There was the fashion of dipping things into red soil or the yellowish soil, the clay. When I touch it, I can still have the red soil remaining in my hands. And, yeah, I can't explain how special that is to me because I realized that was my grandmother making this piece of clothing for her first daughter. My mother is the first child. And it's just so special that she handed it to her and that my mother is handing it to me. You know, it's a different message completely now because she was doing it for her child to just cover up, you know, and it was a proper cover at the time. And now my mother giving it to me, saying that, yeah, when you do your public speaking, show them this and to rally this message.
Yeah, I love that. I love that so much. And it was actually my first time coming across something like that. I didn't know what it was called. I've always seen just images of how I never knew. I knew isbesh. Is that for men? That I never knew about Imgciyo, but I knew about isbesh. So when did your love for agriculture and sustainable living start?
I grew up at home. My mother, she says when she was a young girl, she was planting spinach to sell so that she could have money to pay school fees. So you can imagine that she grew with that, and she got married into my family. My grandmother, my father's mom. Yeah, she was also like a badass farmer, like completely. When I grew up, all I remember is potatoes. A lot of potatoes when I was a child. My grandmother's garden. We would go harvest potatoes, and fruit trees everywhere, spinach. I grew up around food, a lot of food, like planted food, grown food. And when my mother moved and got her own plot to build, what the first thing she was wanting to do was to fence off the plot so that we can plant. So my childhood is just planting, you know, and she would sell, you know. When I came back, I went to boarding school in high school. When I came back home, we would have planted stuff in January before you go. And then when I came back for Easter, it was harvest time. And whoever got to the gate when someone was coming to buy something, the money was theirs. That's how my mother raised us, you know. You had to be a salesperson, you know, be good with your words and get people to buy so that you can have money. So that's a setup I grew up. And, I mean, agriculture for me in high school was inevitable. It was just home. And because I was like, I mean, if I have something that I like, that is production of food, there is no day that people will say, oh, I think I'm done eating today. So it's a business that's ongoing, you know. You can never ever say, okay, people have had enough of food for the next 20 years. Business is bad. No. So I was like, okay, this is lucrative for me because I love business in general. And yeah, and with passion, then everything is possible.
I mean, I can see the passion coming through with your beads and with your whole brand of Uhamba Crafts. When did that really start? Is it something you started as well once you came back from studying?
Yes, actually, because when I came back to the country, 1st of December 2018, I was left with my salary and I was like, oops, what am I going to do? Like, it was my last stipend, not even salary. And I was like, okay, let me take my flight and go to Nairobi, go buy stuff. Because when I lived in Uganda the previous year, I had fallen in love with the crafts. And people kept saying, oh, we buy them from Nairobi. And I asked where, and they told me the name. And I went to Nairobi because I have a friend there that I met in a conference. And I was like, okay, that's it. Nairobi it is. And I went.
Yeah.
And I stocked up some beads, came back to the country. And I was selling stuff on my backpack, going to people's offices and things like that. So when things were broken, I would have to fix the beads. That's when I realized, oh, okay, I can do this. And I started my line of earrings. That was early 2019. And then I just kept going, and I never stopped. I kept getting ideas, and I would go on and on and on and on. Some pieces would sell, like cupcakes, and yeah. And it just started like that.
Wow, no, that's really impressive. It's really, like, beadwork, and it's, I'm just always so super impressed with how people just sit for hours, because I can imagine it doesn't take, it's not a week thing. One must obviously book in advance. So having studied abroad and being the avid traveler that you are, when you're away from your village, what is the one thing that you miss about your village the most? For me, it's the sound of chickens waking us up and the smell of fresh cow dung.
I love food. I'm a foodie. So the things I miss is normally imifino, isopu. Like, I just miss food when I'm away. I would normally take some nice stuff that I like when I travel, like chutney, raja, aromat, roiko soup, and just things that are going to remind me of home. So the first thing I'll think about is just my mother's umosho and gravy, like proper gravy.
Oh, wow.
And speaking the language, you know, without mixing and stopping by, you know, in our culture, you know, that we stop when you greet an elderly person and then they'll talk. You just ask them, how are you, Makul? And then they'll go on and on and on and on and on. You're like, okay. And listening to that, it's like them just talking and sharing a piece of themselves with you. I would miss that. No, they're like, hi, how are you? Someone's not even answering. They're already going or they're just smiling. And I'm like, can you just ask me how I am and pause and stop and listen to me? Those are things I normally miss.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. I mean, when I read that part about the greetings and how important it is, it reminded me of my grandmother, because she always made sure that when a visitor came to our house, we needed to just stop and go and greet them properly, without just handing them the tea or whatever it is that you were giving to them. You needed to properly impart some words and just be interested. And I think that goes a long way, especially with just what you're trying to impart with this book and trying to, you know, people must give the culture a chance, you know, and learn what it is that we have, I mean, our forefathers have been doing for the years, and it's just the richness that comes with it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. You clearly wrote this book with people like myself in mind. As the new Makoti that I am, I appreciate the inclusion of the breakdown of the attire, what each garment represents. I mean, for me, I was told what it was, just in passing, Ikakata and everything and what it means. Because, I mean, my mother will tell me, this is where you keep your secrets, as she was dressing me and all of those things. So to have it in writing and just something I can refer back to is just so empowering in itself. And I also really appreciate the fact that you included a whole section on clan names, because this is something we as Xhosa people take pride in knowing, imvelaphi yethu. I want to understand, though, the whole section of isiduko and how you brought it down, because you do mention that there is five different groups of Xhosa people. Can you maybe just roughly share how you've broken them down in this book?
Yeah, so I'll say firstly that I don't have all of isiduko mentioned in the book. So some people are asking me, why is it that Isidukosam is not there? And I'm like, that's what I could get in the archive I was accessing information from. And I didn't want to, it's not very easy to get isiduko. So this is what I could get. And I broke them down based on the tribes or the groups, Sabatembu, Amakosa, Amabaka, Amampondomise, and all that. So I'm just breaking them into that, because then in that way you see where each person is coming from. You know, for example, Amabaka, you'll know that they're coming from Swaziland, and that Mabomfane, mostly Chesi clan, they came from KZN. So it's kind of like tracking, because in his class, when you're singing praises of the clan, it tells you who came from who came from so-and-so, who came from this and that. And then in between, they'll have jingles and plays that maybe there was a dirty one among them, there was a fighter, a warrior, there was a lover of cows, there was a lover of women, you know. You hear that in the praise. So if you take time to listen to the praise, you get to see it's not a stereotype, but you get to understand the group of people, you know. These ones are famous of this. These ones, the Mamfengu, they were said to be famous of being learned and civilized and everything. And to this day, you see how their areas are improved and in terms of structures, in terms of being in big offices. So you understand who is who and why. And I think that's important. That's why in Xhosa, when you meet someone for the first time, what is your clan
name?
And when they tell you their clan name, then associations come, you know, because people were always looking for marrying their daughters into this and that family. So when they are asking, they want to know if you are related or not. And if you are not related, then you are looking for relations, you know. So isiduko is the most beautiful thing. Even if you meet umfana, like a guy who's going to go out with you, who wants to date you, the first thing they'll ask is isiduko. And if you have the same clan name, then it's mission aborted because there's nothing you can do. Isiduko is more important, I say, is more important than the surname. You can have different surnames because surnames are people's names that are handed down. But this duko remains the same. It's just one name that transcends surnames. So, yeah, this duko is very profound. And it's amazing how what information you can get just from someone telling you is duko sab. You know?
Which part of the book was the most fun to write for you? The one you were mostly excited about?
I love all the topics. The topic of food. I cooked almost all the dishes I talk about there. I cooked them and I took the photos. So that for me was the most special one.
I really like the fact that you do include all the pictures here. Also, I mean, for someone who doesn't even know what you're speaking about, when you speak of Igogo, they're able to see. And when they do come to the village, they'll be able to see, oh, that's what they meant. And for me, just what it means, what Igogo in itself means to a woman. Like I said, there may have been some points where, as we've discussed earlier, that, you know, women aren't always seen in a positive light or aren't always treated, you know, equally amongst the men in the culture. But there's so many important parts that we embody, that we own, and we give such power to, which is something I really admire about the culture. We have grounded thing about us as the Xhosa women. Do you have any parting words for the book community and readers who would love to educate themselves about the rich Xhosa culture?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I've had people ask me a lot of questions. So now all I say is just get the book. Don't upset them alone. The book will just enlighten different topics you never even imagined existed in the Xhosa culture. Especially if you live in the city and you want to connect to your roots and understand the culture of the people. I think after you read this book, you will have a very softer heart towards the Xhosa culture because you understand the depth and the reasons why sometimes people do what they do in the culture. So, yeah, those are my parting words. Thank you.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Thank you so much, Mercy. In closing, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing such a big part of your life with us, as well as the knowledge that's passed on to you by the elders. I want to thank you for honoring the Xhosa Nation. Siyabulela kakhulu, sithungadinwa. We are definitely reviving our heritage with this book, and I hope anyone that reads it truly honors it for what it is, a gift and an answered prayer to all of us. I will continue to take this book with me everywhere I go because it brings me a new sense of pride in my culture and it gives me hope that we are powerful beyond measure as the Ndu people. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of PageCast. We have an incredible lineup of author interviews, so head over to our Facebook and Instagram and follow Jonathan Ball Publishers to stay updated and in the know regarding future episodes. Thanks for your interest in the story behind the story. Happy reading from everyone at PageCast.